Just after midnight, Californians woke up to a new reality.
Now in California, driving while holding a cell phone is against the law.
The state with the most cars and the most highways in the nation is finally going hands-free. The cell phone industry fought it tooth and nail, and California lawmakers spent 6 years trying to pass the new restriction. Now state police say they'll aggressively enforce the new law. Here's NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates.
The warnings have been coming for months. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger held a press conference a few weeks ago to remind Californians that their driving laws were going to change soon.
We know that cell phones are the number one cause of distracted driving accidents. And according to some estimates, getting drivers' hands off the cell phones and onto the steering wheel will save almost 300 lives a year in California.
A lot of people approve. In downtown Culver City, Linda Albrecht tells me why she does.
I believe you should not drive and talk at the same time. When my children call me, I say, I hope you aren't driving. Get off the phone.
Yesterday, Steve Thomas was still holding on to his cell.
I will today probably, but probably not tomorrow.
Thomas has no plans to go hands-free. He says he'll put down his phone and enjoy the silence.
It'll be kind of nice, I think.
There have been television PSAs like the one you just heard, online warnings and big signs on the highways telling drivers the new law starts immediately in July. Standing near his motorcycle on the patio of the California Highway Patrol office in Culver City, Sergeant Rhett Price says as far as he's concerned, the sooner the law goes into effect, the better.
A day hasn't gone by that I don't see somebody using their cell phone, talking on the phone with one hand, changing lanes without properly looking over their shoulder or checking to the left or to the right, and almost causing a collision. In fact, I've had it happen several times with me.
California's cell-held threat is being eliminated, but there are plenty other things that are still legal. For now, you can still drive and dial or even send a text message. As for other possible distractions, there are no laws prohibiting makeup application, shaving, or negotiating a chili burger while driving. Which doesn't mean you can't be cited. California's Safe Speed Law is an amazingly flexible tool that allows officers to cite people whose behind-the-wheel multitasking makes them a danger to themselves and others. Sergeant Rhett Price.
There are just some things that people have to understand they shouldn't be doing while they're driving. We can argue in court why it was unsafe for somebody to be texting or putting on their mascara or eating a sloppy burger at the time that they were driving their vehicle.
For now, the public focus is on hands-free phoning. As the deadline approached, people rushed to comply with the law.
We've been selling tons of these.
Greg Carter is general manager of Costco in Hawthorne, California. The new law is prominently posted here above a 6-foot-high display of hands-free headsets. Carter says this display is considerably smaller now than it was even a few weeks ago.
Early on, there was some confusion that the law was going to start in January, so we did see a spike in sales in late December and early January, but nothing like what we've seen over the past 4 weeks.
The kits Costco carries cost from $40 to $60. That one-time expense may spare drivers the price of a ticket. The first-time citation is $20, but with court costs, that could go up to $76. The next time, it could be as much as $192, and it gets increasingly expensive after that. One group who won't be rushing to buy hands-free kits are drivers under 18. The new law forbids them from driving and talking, period. During his press conference, Governor Schwarzenegger urged parents to be strict and says he's already laid down the law to his teenage daughters.
I told them that if I catch them driving with, cell phones in their hands or making any calls, that the car will be gone and the cell phones will be gone.
Many auto safety experts would applaud that, since some research argues it's not holding the phone, but talking on it that's the biggest danger to drivers of all ages. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
What can I do? I feel so blue. I've got to give this message to you. I'm sending you a
As of today, computer users can no longer buy the operating system Windows XP. And that means consumers will have to buy the newer Vista operating system. We called Lance Ulanoff, the editor-in-chief of PC Magazine, to tell us more about it. Good morning.
Good morning.
Why is Microsoft doing this?
They actually have a new product out there, Vista, and they're really trying to drive people to buying that new operating system, whether they like it or not.
Why wouldn't people want the newer system?
Well, it's very interesting. There were many great promises about the Vista operating system, and I think that Microsoft may have under-delivered a little bit. It is not as easy to use as it should be. It basically is a little bit dissatisfying, and everybody was finally quite satisfied with Windows XP.
But forcing people to buy the new system, whether they like it or not, does not seem like the best way to please your customer base.
It's interesting because they're not entirely moving on. First of all, they're going to sell out whatever XP is still on shelves. They're not really going to pull it. They're just going to say, we're not going to ship it to you anymore so you can sell it. Sell what you have. Also, system manufacturers, they're still going to be selling XP systems until the end of this year and maybe even a little bit after that.
Any other options for people who are just frustrated with Vista and don't want it?
There's always eBay and friends with old copies, but those options are going to become more and more limited. And obviously, well, Microsoft has promised extended support. You know, their attention will start to turn away from this operating system, and so will manufacturers, which means that when you buy new stuff, you may no longer find XP drivers.
Well, what are people's complaints generally about Vista?
They find it confusing. They find that their hardware doesn't work with it. It is a learning curve. They understood how Windows XP worked. Windows XP wasn't—there was kind of this thread of connection, and Vista's a big change. And, for example, it does annoying things. There was a very big push on security, except that every time you do something, something pops up to ask you, do you really want to do that? Yeah, it's like, yes, I press the button. Of course I want to do that. But, you know, to Microsoft's credit, Vista is actually a pretty good operating system. It is more secure. It does have a lot of features. And having said that, that's one of the problems. It has a lot of features. Mm-hmm. It's overwhelming to most people.
Does the fact that some customers are dissatisfied with Vista mean they're going to migrate to Macs?
This is prime time for Apple, and they are taking it to Microsoft. You've seen the ads. They know there is an opening here, and a lot of home users are making that choice. Businesses, on the other hand, they're still going with Windows, and they're having the hardest time because, you know, they want to stick with what the whole company is standardized on, which is going to be XP. They don't want to upgrade, and they'll work not to for as long as they can.
So you think while businesses may be stuck with Microsoft, whether they like it or not, individuals for their home computers may make the switch?
Oh, I think so. I think more and more they are because they understand the Macintosh operating system. That platform is a really easy to use, safe operating system. There isn't tremendous confusion. It isn't bloated. And most of those things are true. But as the Apple platform becomes more popular, Macintoshes may be under threat of attack, meaning that, you know, more people will write malware to attack them.
Malware meaning like viruses.
Spyware, exactly.
Lance Ulanoff is editor-in-chief of PC Magazine. Thanks a lot.
It's a pleasure.
From NPR News, this is Weekend Edition. I'm Leanne Hansen. This month on our program, we've been examining the state of America's infrastructure. We've heard about the problems with the country's roads, levees, water systems, and bridges. The question today is, who's going to pay to make improvements? Well, certainly we'll all pay in higher taxes, but what about private industry? What's in it for them to invest directly in public works? Coming up, a report from Kurt Nickisch about private investment. But first, we want to focus on efforts by elected officials to push for greater federal funding for infrastructure. This past January, California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger spoke in front of a backdrop of snarled highway trestles. He was flanked by New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg and Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell.
The bottom line is that America right now needs $1.6 trillion to rebuild and to really invest in the future. I think it is very important that we take this seriously. This is why we formed this coalition, to put the spotlight on this issue nationwide. We must get going. We must invest.
California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell joins us by phone. Welcome to the program, sir.
Hi, Leanne. How are you?
Very well, thank you. You, Mayor Bloomberg, Governor Schwarzenegger, you've teamed up to form a coalition that's called Building America's Future. What do you hope to accomplish?
Well, that's right. We're the founding fathers, but we hope to get every local, county, and state government enlisted in Building America's Future, and to deliver a message to Washington that if America is going to have a future, an economically viable future, a quality of life future, a future that involves public safety, we have to begin the business of repairing our infrastructure. Governor Schwarzenegger, in that tape you just played, mentioned $1.6 trillion. He didn't pull that out of thin air. That was a report from the American Society of Civil Engineers. It said that for America to repair its infrastructure, just repair what we have, would cost $1.6 trillion.
Each state has its own issues. Pennsylvania has a unique set of infrastructure issues. What do you consider to be the top priorities in your state?
The top priority, just because we have so many roads and so many rivers and streams, is bridges. We lead the nation in the most structurally deficient bridges. We also have a huge problem on our wastewater, clean water and wastewater systems as well, $15, $20 billion statewide problem. So we have a ton of problems, and we're willing to do our part, but we need federal help, and the federal government's got to step up.
Let's talk a little bit about the Pennsylvania Turnpike. Last month, a Spanish firm and Citigroup bid some $12.8 billion to lease the Turnpike, and it's the state's only toll road at the moment. And you'd been pushing for this deal for quite a while, but this past week, the Pennsylvania Senate unanimously voted against the plan. How do you think this is going to affect foreign investment in your infrastructure?
Well, I think there's still a place for it. What I have told the legislature is if you're worried about foreign investment, then don't fly into Orlando. Don't you take your family to Disney World, because guess who runs the Orlando airport? You want to take a guess, Leanne?
I don't know.
Albertus.
Oh, the same company. One of the same companies.
The company that is bidding to run the turnpike runs the Orlando airport. If we're going to meet our infrastructure goals, if we're going to repair our roads, repair our bridges, do something about our wastewater and water systems, we're going to have to be creative, and the federal government's also going to have to step up.
You called yourself and Mayor Bloomberg and Governor Schwarzenegger kind of the founding fathers of this transportation coalition. Earlier this month, I mean, speaking of founding fathers, we spoke to historian Robert Fishman about the history of infrastructure planning in this country. We want to play a little clip from that interview because he describes how Thomas Jefferson, Secretary of the Treasury, Albert Gallatin, put together a national plan for roads and canals.
Think about the incredible task of spanning a continent, of uniting this vast area into one country, into one economy. This was inconceivable without conscious national planning at the largest scale. Gallatin was a great economist, and he understood that maintenance was at least as important as initial investment.
Governor Ed Rendell, what do you think Gallatin and the Founding Fathers would have to say about the situation today?
Well, I think if they were here, they would take a look at where we are, and I think they would hear to one of our basic suggestions, and that's for a federal capital budget. You know, the federal government builds roads the same way it buys paper clips. Paper clips have a 30-day half-life. Roads have a 30-year life. It's crazy. No one else does it in the entire U.S. Every state, county, and local government has a capital budget. You need a federal capital budget to get an infrastructure repair program along the level of the $1.6 trillion that Governor Schwarzenegger talked about. And we need to restore the public's confidence. So major infrastructure projects, some money will continue to go to the states, but major infrastructure projects go to this infrastructure bank that Senator Hagel, Senator Dodd have proposed, that Senator Obama is backing. And that infrastructure bank gives the yay or nay based on a good cost-benefit analysis of projects, particularly projects that take more than one state in.
So it's possible to build on the legacy of Gallatin.
Oh, absolutely. It just takes the will to get this done. And the time to get it done is now. And think about one other benefit from this, Leanne. We're in a stagnant economy and maybe even a full-blown recession. If we spend over the next 5 years, 5-6 years, repairing every aspect of the American infrastructure, building out a passenger rail system, what would we produce? Well, number one, we'd produce maybe millions of jobs, high-paying jobs for Americans that can't, by their very nature, can't be outsourced. Secondly, we'd produce a whole boatload of orders for American steel and concrete and timber companies, for companies who produce all sorts of supplies. So it would be a huge shot in the arm for the economy, probably the best economic stimulus you could do. So you'd get a side benefit from the most important benefit, repairing and expanding our infrastructure, improving our economic competitiveness, our quality of life, and our public safety.
Governor Rendell, you sound like you might make a good Secretary of Transportation in the next administration. I mean, is it an offer that you would accept?
Well, I said on a TV show in Harrisburg Thursday night that I would be very interested in serving in either energy or transportation, but that would have to be after I served my term as governor. If that position were open in January of 2011, I'd love to take a shot at something like that.
Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell, thanks so much.
Thanks, Leanne. Have a great rest of the week.
You too.
For those city workers who spend their fifth day at home saving gas, our last word is 3D TV. The time may soon come for American Idol to spring off the screen at you. Unfortunately, right now, 3D TV is only available in Japan. Japanese cable channels now broadcast 3D programs several times a day. To watch all those programs, you need a special TV and special glasses for a total of about $4,000. The programming is also reportedly limited at the moment. It includes clips from motorcycle races and scenic video of rural Japan. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
For some, the money to fix the nation's bridges and roads can be found on one of those roads, Wall Street. Investment companies are raising capital in so-called infrastructure funds. The idea is to help, say, a county government hold down costs and make money in the process. NPR's Kurt Nickisch filed this report.
Hi there, how's it going? Can I have a receipt, please? Thanks. So, I just paid $1.25 to go through the toll on the Massachusetts Turnpike, and some people look at my car and the steady stream of cars behind me that are annoyed that I'm just pulling out now, and think, these tolls really aren't bad business models.
They provide stability and cash flow, which are nice qualities in an investment.
That's Peter Lucchetti. He is with the investment firm Table Rock Capital in California, and he's been raising literally billions of dollars to help public agencies build toll roads and power lines and sewer pipe around the country. Infrastructure funds are not new, but they're pretty popular right now. U.S. firms have raised about $100 billion in them over the last 5 years. Sure, the recent credit crunch has made investing in concrete things more attractive, but Lucchetti says the real reason for the boom is the nation's looming infrastructure needs.
Even before the credit crisis, that train was coming down our track and was getting closer and closer and closer. And that pressure is becoming quite intense now.
It's quite intense because the money has to come from somewhere. Ray Levitt, a public policy expert at Stanford, says it's getting harder for local and state governments to raise money through bonds.
A combination of that plus an allergy to taxes in the U.S. has meant that public agencies are very cash-strapped to come up with the capital costs. So there's a tremendous unmet need for infrastructure.
That's where private money could come in. Other countries do this a lot already. Investor Peter Lucchetti says they're able to save as much as 30% on the cost of big projects when they team up with private investors to take advantage of their business expertise.
So there's a real gain to be had by tapping into those private sector management skills and having them benefit the public sector.
With savings like that, you might think that domestic projects would be cropping up left and right.
Well, that hasn't happened.
John Foote researches this field at Harvard. He says one reason this trend is getting off the ground more slowly in the U.S. than many people expected is because these deals are complicated. They're hard for policymakers to explain to voters. Each project is different, and Foote thinks infrastructure funds will do well if they focus on the ones with the clearest benefit to society.
And although these public-private partnerships are not the silver bullet for our infrastructure problems in this country, they could be one important possible solution.
One possible solution, Foote says, because even with the $100 billion they've got now, these investment funds still won't come close to paying for all of the country's infrastructure needs. Kurt Nickisch, NPR News.
At the America 2050 conference in May, thinkers and policymakers gathered to imagine what our country should look like by mid-century. Armando Carbonell from the Lincoln Institute of Land Policy in Cambridge, Massachusetts, was one of the attendees, and he joins us from the studios of MIT. Hi, welcome to the program.
Pleasure to be with you, Leanne.
One of the big topics that was driving discussions at the forum was the concept of America's mega regions. Could you first tell us what those are, and then how do they help envision a new kind of infrastructure?
Happy to do it. A series you've been presenting over the last month on infrastructure, by the way, I think has painted a very clear picture of what's gone wrong with our national infrastructure system. We need a national vision and an integrated strategy, but this really has to be informed by the regional differences and a kind of bottom-up process of planning. Mega-regions are big systems of metropolitan areas like the Northeast Corridor that stretches from Boston to Washington, and they're the right scale for major infrastructure decision-making. For example, for big systems like high-speed rail, which Europe and Asia are literally thousands of miles ahead of us in developing.
And so that would help us if we look to Asia and Europe and how they're dealing with their so-called mega-regions, we could learn something from them.
These are our competitors. In Europe, which we've studied for some time, we know that the European Union is working across national boundaries to integrate the continent. Something we started out to do here across state lines in the early days, as your series has pointed out, but there's been at least a 50-year gap in national planning for comprehensive infrastructure across water systems, energy systems, and transportation.
You know, I would imagine that the founding fathers didn't really think about climate change as they were planning infrastructure. How do you think climate change affects infrastructure planning today?
It's clearly making a big difference, and I'd have to say I don't think we've thought much about climate change until quite recently, but there is a new consensus that we will be transitioning to lower carbon energy sources, and we need to begin as soon as possible. That and higher energy prices, which we've been reacting to around the country in recent months, represent new realities. They mean we're going to have to use new criteria in making decisions about investments in automotive versus transit modes, for example.
In your op-ed piece for the Boston Globe, you recommended some broad changes in mass transit, land use, energy-efficient building construction, but you also noted how this summer some families are going to be staying closer to home rather than hitting the road in the family car. How do you think American culture and mindset will need to adapt to a new kind of infrastructure?
What I would like to think of as a new geography of opportunity in America. People are going to drive less. They'll buy more fuel-efficient vehicles. When it comes time to relocate, they'll think about their needs and, I think, in general, choose more centralized opportunities. And over time, I think we will see lifestyle changes. And I base that on what I see happening today.
Armando Carbonell is chairman of the Department of Planning and Urban Form at the Lincoln Institute of Land Policy, and he joined us from the MIT studios in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Leah.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.